George Galrisa is a psychologist from the United States. When he was starting out, he was asked to become involved with the Ohio police in helping with a preventative program against family violence, which was very successful. Then one day George was brought by police to a situation at a local hospital. In the hospital was a patient who was paranoid and dangerous and had taken a nurse hostage. Without much preparation at all, George was sent in by police to defuse the situation, and then George took the hostage's place with a blade against his neck. That was the beginning of George Galrisa's long career as a hostage negotiator. It wasn't in the original plan that George had for his life. He was going to become a priest, and he spent 8 years in a seminary. Now George conducts courses in leadership and organizational behavior at IMD Business School in Switzerland. Hello, George. Welcome.
Good morning, Richard.
What does hostage negotiation have in common with teaching leadership?
That's a very good question. And it is at the heart of what leaders have to do. They have to be able to create relationships, even with people they don't like, even with despicable people, and be able to engage in dialogue, be able to understand the motivation, and then through the process of influencing and persuasion, get people to change their mindset towards some benefit. This is what hostage negotiators do with weapons. Now, here's the interesting thing. You don't have to have a scissors to your throat or a weapon to your head to feel like a hostage. You can be a hostage to a boss, to a board, colleagues, in personal life, to spouses, children, teachers, doctors. So the methods that we use in hostage negotiation are really appropriate for leaders to do the process of influencing.
Is the psychological approach to hostage negotiation, by and large, really, it seems to me, just having read about your career, it seems to require you, under circumstances of extreme duress, to establish some point of empathy or sympathy with a person that most people wouldn't normally see as a terribly sympathetic human being. Is that what it is?
Yes, you can learn to create that empathy, create a bond. We actually talk about a bond with somebody you don't like, somebody who's repulsive, but you have to be able to make that connection. And respect is the kind of foundation to making that happen.
Isn't there that old saying that there are those in the world who you can completely despise until you see through a chink in their armor the sight of something nailed down and in torment?
Yeah, that's really fundamental. And it starts in the mind's eye. So you have to be able to see something good in every person. And here's the thing, Richard. When people are taking hostages, they're driven by some desperate loss. And we don't pay enough attention in organizations with the amount of loss that people are going through. So leaders often miss that as a fundamental motivation. Now, this process of creating a bond, engaging in a dialogue, then negotiating, what do you think the success rate would be of hostage negotiators?
I have no idea.
It's about 95%.
95%?
Success.
When you're dealing with someone who's taken a hostage, what different personality types are you dealing with? Like, often I know you're dealing with people who are paranoid, but sometimes there'll be someone who's got a different kind of mental illness, like profound schizophrenia. They may be suffering hallucinations and have perceived enemies. Do you have to be able to quickly recognize what is what?
Recognize what's going on with the personality and what kind of person you're dealing with. Also know why they're doing what the hostage taking is. The two most dangerous are revenge. People who are hell-bent on revenge, they can't see anything else, and police by suicide, or suicide by police, where they want the police to kill them, they don't want to kill themselves. Those are the two most dangerous. And then you have other types of hostage situations based on whether they want money and domestic disputes, and et cetera.
Is a large part of it just simply listening, just being listening to people who have been seen to be despised or something, and then they can't find anyone to listen to what they're going through and to be an audience for that person?
I think it's listening, but then the most important part is the question that's asked after listening. So it's about deep dive into the motivation, so that somebody is saying something. You have to hear their pain. Like with Sam, the man who took me hostage in the hospital, it was all about his kids. It was the pain of his kids. So you have to be able then to ask the right question. And sometimes that question has to also be provocative.
What about fear, your own terror, that you might lose your life? You have a blade at your throat or a gun at your head. What do you have to do with that fear? Do you have to suppress it, put it out of mind, or channel it?
You have to do all of those, but mostly be able to change it and not let it influence you. So there is a startle reflex, which can happen where you're suddenly surprised by something, and you can't have the startle reflex. You have to train yourself not to feel it. And then the second part is training the amygdala to not have strong stress reactions when you face fear or some really threatening situation.
Like scream or something. And go, yeah. Ah, don't do that. Or put that
that's,
down. Yeah.
That's not the best transaction to use.
Because you want to make the scene calmer.
Yeah, you want to make the scene calmer, but you want to show caring. And this is what it really might surprise people. Hostage negotiators have to have a certain amount of caring that authentically comes through. I care about you and why you want to kill somebody. Or I care enough to know, I want to understand what you need, and I'm going to do everything I can to help get that need met. Just like leaders have to show caring. And how many leaders are very, very uncaring? And they create havoc.
It seems to me these sympathies that can emerge out of these really strange, tense, life-threatening, I'm going to kill you situations are fascinating. Is this something like the opposite of Stockholm Syndrome or something like Stockholm Syndrome, where the person who's captured or held hostage becomes to sympathize with not just with the person who's taking them hostage, but their goals and what they want to achieve?
Yeah, like Patty Hearst many years ago, and still happens. The Stockholm Syndrome, for those who don't know what it is where the hostage forms a bond with the hostage taker and creates an alliance against the police. So it's a survival mechanism. If I am treated with a little bit of respect by the hostage taker, I begin to feel a little bit of caring, and that can actually grow to where you feel love. You feel a connection, emotional connection, and lose your perspective of why you're there. It's a survival mechanism. And hostage negotiation has a lot to do with neuroscience, how the brain works, and how the brain can get sidetracked, and how decisions of what you say or do are influenced by the emotions.
The path you've taken to become reach that point of becoming a hostage negotiator is kind of fascinating, George. Where did you grow up in the United States?
In a small little city called Wapakoneta, an old Indian village. Our one claim to fame is Neil Armstrong.
Well, he was from there too.
He was from Wapakoneta. And it was an old Indian village, and I grew up on a farm there. And so I was really well grounded in understanding many different types of people.
Did you do farm work as a kid?
Yep.
What kind of work?
Well, we had a traditional farm, so driving tractors, milking the cows in the morning, feeding the pigs and the sheep, and all those nice things you do on a farm, as well as the social part of it. So the whole idea with my there were five kids, four brothers and sisters, and we lived in the whole area where my 10 uncles and aunts from my father's side and also 9 from my mother's side, we were always bonding. We were always engaged in social activities. That was one of the great, great blessings of my life.
Also, it was very warm then, very warm childhood, you recall.
Work hard and respect and bond to people.
How religious was the family?
Very. My mother was quite religious, and so I, being the oldest male child in a strong Catholic family, a German Catholic family, thought that I had a vocation. People often ask me, Richard, well, did you have to go or did they want you to go? Yes, and I felt it was a decision, although as I look back, it was highly influenced by many things. So I left home when I was 12. Yeah.
So how did you then become involved in the life of the church, the institutions of the church? What was the starting point?
Well, the starting point was an altar boy, and it's a very interesting process when you are young. You do these religious activities and retreats, and so it's a process where you are basically thinking, well, maybe I have a vocation. And in the Catholic Church, the calling from God to be a priest is a very sacred thing. And suddenly you start saying, do I have that? And then people around you say, well, you probably do.
What did you enjoy about being an altar boy then? What was the pleasure of that then that made you want to go into a seminary?
It was. That's a very interesting question. It was the sense of something that's meaningful, something that's purposeful, that you're connected with the divine, a higher power, so that you're just not caught in the day-to-day mundane things, but here something is useful, something is serving a divine purpose.
So were you approached to go into the seminary, or did you say, I want to go?
I wanted to go. I wanted to go. Although I became a hostage after a certain point. I would have made a terrible priest.
Maybe not.
But I made the choice, and it was wonderful because we lived, there were like 300 kids in the seminary.
And how old were you when you went
in? I was 12.
12 years old when you went in?
Yeah.
Did that mean you had to leave your family?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We lived there with each other, and it was wonderful to work, pray, and play, and study with these young kids.
Did your family mind letting you go at the age of 12?
Well, they had grief. I had grief, but it was all part of the divine. It was all that sense of, well, here's a mission and purpose. And so I learned very early how to sacrifice personal needs. Well, you do this anyway on a farm, because if you don't feel like getting up to milk the cows, you get up to milk the cows anyway. So you learn that there is some higher process going on. And so the grief becomes easier. And by the way, that did help me with hostage taking, because every hostage taker is driven by grief, driven by a loss.
What was the daily routine like in the seminary for you as a kid?
We woke up at 6:40 in the morning, or 5:40. 20 minutes to get dressed.
I think I could do 6:40. 5:40.
5:40 was the wake-up call. And then you rush down to wash and brush your teeth, get ready, and then meditation at 6 and mass at 6.
Meditation at 6?
Yeah.
What did that mean?
It meant sleeping. Not really. No, meditation meant you spent 15 minutes thinking about the day. In silence, yeah. Just quiet. And then you would have mass. And then you would start the day with breakfast. And then you would start classes a little later. Some days you worked half the day, Wednesdays and Saturdays. But it was a very structured routine. Time to go to class. And it was Jesuit-type training. So I have to say, after 8 years of Latin, I don't remember much, but it was quite disciplined.
You're painting a picture of this seminary with these kind of really disciplined and dedicated 12-year-olds and kids.
Yeah.
That are spiritually ambitious. Was that the case?
Well, I would say that most had that religious foundation somewhere, but the attrition rate was very high. So after 6 months, I think 20 of the kids dropped out of our class of 68. Eventually, only 2 were ordained, which is not very good statistics out of 68.
What was the quality of education like outside of the religious sphere?
Oh, it was not that much religious. It was traditional science, mathematics, all the traditional courses that you would take if you were in high school, except you had the discipline structure that we had a prefect who would oversee the studying, and it was very the time you got up to the time you went to bed was all discipline. You all went to bed at the same time, 9 o'clock.
Given the revelations here and in the United States, I do have to ask, was there sexual abuse in such a place that you were aware of? Yeah,
I was never approached. I never saw it personally, but there were rumors. And suddenly there were some kids who would be leaving, which was a no-no. But I never personally experienced it or was ever approached. And there was always that as a no-no. Anything that had to do with women, anything that had to do with sexuality was a non-subject to talk about.
Did you take to this regimented life, or were you ever a bit of a rebel, George?
I was a rebel.
In what way? What'd you do?
Well, I would not be at where I was supposed to be on time, or I can tell you secretly. I worked in the meat shop. I worked in the boiler room, so I had access to hot coals. I had a friend who was in the meat shop, and another one in the bakery, and another one who was knew the housekeeping system. So we would occasionally get meat and bread and pop and things, and go out and have a barbecue at 4 o'clock or at 2 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes we got caught. And the punishment was to do dishes. I spent most of my first 3 years doing dishes.
So did you stay with the seminary through your university years?
Yeah. So I stayed through 4 years of high school. Then there was 2 years of university, so St. Joseph's college in Rensselaer, and then a year of silence, and then two more years of discipline, and that was all connected to the University of Dayton. So we got a degree in philosophy, and then I eventually moved to psychology.
Now, the year of silence, I've got to ask you about this. This, at some level, sounds terrifying and sounds beautiful as well, and sounds, I don't know, what was it? Describe what that was like and how you embarked on this year of silence.
Well, we all knew it was coming, and it was part of the ritual to be able to go into the advanced seminary training so that you could talk to your spiritual director. That was okay. And then there would be some exceptional days like Easter and Christmas, because you didn't go home at all during that year, where you would have a few hours that you could talk to other people. Otherwise, you always use signs to communicate what you wanted. And meditation.
What was the perceived benefit of a year of silence?
Go into yourself, Richard. It was, and actually it's a very powerful thing, because in this hectic world, how many people really go into mindfulness? That's the whole new trend now, getting mindful, to go deeper in yourself. So it's a very powerful thing to just sit and meditate and walk and meditate to get in touch with your deeper self and different deeper feelings and ideas.
How did you feel going into it, George?
Scared as hell.
Yeah.
Yeah, and because you to imagine what this would be like. And I always had a thing that was an escape. I had a special hobby, which was trapping. So I wouldn't do it anymore today, but at that time, growing up in a farm, we all learned how to trap muskrats and coons and fox, and my specialty was fox. So I was allowed to do that during my seminary days, and that was a real ventilation, I would say. It was an out for me to get out in nature and do things. And that was meditative in a way, but it was part of life that I really enjoyed.
In that year of silence, did you go to places in your mind that you'd never been before? And what were those places like?
Well, you went into, what do I really want to do? So these were all guided meditations. So you would have regular readings from the Bible, or you would have directions from the spiritual advisor or different priests that were there, as well as studying. So you did study. I mean, it was still regimented study. So you would go into understanding what a particular item meant in your life, or what anger meant, you know, and when you're with other young people, at this point we weren't kids, but anger was a part of the life. Fear was part of the life. Jealousy was part of the life. All of these natural emotions that occur where people exist. But then you went deeper into understanding what it was about.
I've had that experience when you go for a whole day.
Yeah.
Doing hard labor. You're like, you know, in a garden or something like that, alone.
Yeah.
And you don't talk to anyone for a whole day. At the end of the day, you feel kind of amazing, actually. You do feel really good. But I wonder what it's like to do that after a week and then a month.
Well, it's like Gethsemane and you know, some of the traditional Benedictines who spend their life in silence. You become friends with yourself. You really get to know yourself. And if you can't be calm with yourself, then you have to get help, because it's hell if you're in silence and you hate yourself or you're filled with a lot of negative emotions. So I would say it's exactly what you experience at the end of the day, a kind of peacefulness.
Given that you were doing a double major in psychology, George, were you kind of like a bit of experimental rat in your own experiment? Were you sort of, was there a part of you standing back going, what George is doing now is interesting, what George is thinking now is interesting?
Well, I was an avid reader in self-help books and reading psychology, and my mother always complained to my dear friends, he reads too much, he's too, but I was very...
He might read himself out of Catholicism, was she worried that or something?
Yeah, she thought I was, she sensed that I was getting ready to go out. Other people knew it before I did. And so, yes, you were allowed to really enrich your mind and enrich your soul of what you wanted in life.
So then how did your thinking evolve then over that year of silence, where, because you had been on this trajectory towards the priesthood?
I realized this was not what I really wanted in life. Was this what really I wanted, what God wanted? And I had a very special spiritual advisor, Father Maziarz, who was at a major seminary, and he came to see me a number of times. And the bolt of lightning that came into my mind came from him when he said, George, you have a right to choose what you want to do. Now, this may seem strange. I was at that point 20 years old, and yet I never really had that thought. I can do what I want to do. I have free choice. I don't have to do anything to be a priest or whatever. And that was actually the beginning of this whole hostage metaphor idea, that you could be a hostage psychologically.
You mean to other people's expectations of you?
Yeah. Or your own expectations. Yeah. I was a hostage to myself. I thought that I would be violating the divine if I had a vocation and didn't stick to it.
Your mum had been battling against cancer for years. And what impact did her death have on you and your family?
Very deep. She fought for life over 6 years, and there wasn't that much treatment for cancer back in those days. And
the '60s or seventies?
Yeah, seventies. Yeah. Seventies. And she really wanted to live, and but she did not. And the whole thing was, I came to terms with grief quite early, understanding grief, I think, is essential to an understanding life, because if you can't face loss, you can't face death, you can't really live life. And so that understanding took me in the direction of going deeper into grief. And I eventually worked with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, one of my great teachers and eventually colleagues and friends, who helped me understand that whole process with my mother and with the other losses in my life.
After you graduated then with your master's degree in psychology, how were you brought into the police then?
My advisor at the university had been frustrated by using traditional psychologists with the police. They had an experimental program to go into homes to deal with violence, and at the time of the police were called in, because homicides in families was about 35% of all the homicides. So you could look at a roster.
35%. This is a real shock to most people to hear these kinds of stats, isn't it?
Yeah.
Within families.
Domestic and sometimes friends to the family. It could be all kinds of conflicts. So the idea was, let's get in at that point when the police come in the first time, the second time, and get a psychologist or a mediator and try to resolve the conflict, get them some help.
Preemptively, right.
Preemptively. Yeah. And they couldn't find anybody who really could get along with the police and deal well with conflict. So I did my dissertation on conflict, and along with another colleague, the two of us were asked to join this team. And so we became part of going into homes with the police or violent situations. If it was safe, the police would leave, or if it wasn't safe, they would stay. And then we would mediate and get them connected to social help.
Was it successful?
Very. It reduced the homicide rate dramatically. In our small city, we would have as high as 90 a year, and we brought it down to under 50. And those that did occur often were not connected to family disputes.
Oh, those people.
So it was very successful.
All those people who were still alive, all those kids who still have parents.
Yeah. And again, see, there's something, Richard, about in life finding something that really has meaning and purpose. I mean, you can do any job and find a way to feel like you're making a contribution to life.
Then there came this incident, this first incident, when you were called out into a hostage situation. Tell me about getting the call.
Okay. This meant working nights and weekends. So I was riding with a lieutenant, and we got a call on the radio that there was a possible hostage situation at a local hospital, and that the man was apparently psychotic. So we rushed to the scene. They had secured the unit, and there was a nurse who was in the room, treatment room, with a man named Sam who was holding her hostage. We didn't know with what kind of weapons. A hospital emergency room is filled with scissors and all kinds of knives and weapons. So they secured the unit, and then the decision was made by the lieutenant, we can't use tear gas because we're in a hospital emergency room. We can't kick the door in. He's very volatile. We need somebody to quietly go in and talk him down.
And then all eyes turned on you, did they, George? At that point?
Not all eyes. His eyes.
His eyes.
He looked at me and he looked around the room, and then he looked at me and said, George, would you be willing to do that? And trusting him and being a risk taker, I said, okay, I'll give it my best. So I got prepared. I got in the door, and he was explosive. He was really, really screaming and shouting how he was going to kill as many people as he could, and having a scissors to the throat of Sheila.
What state was he in?
Was he wounded?
He was wounded. He was stabbed near his heart. He had gone to his home with his to see his kids. He was divorced. His wife, ex-wife, said no, wouldn't let the kids see him. It was against a court order, and he became very violent, and she stabbed him in the process.
And so what? He'd been then taken to hospital?
But the police were called, and he was taken to the hospital in a very, very sort of violent state, and they tried to treat him. He ran the doctors out of the room.
And how it was, and at this point, what did he have against the nurse's throat? A pair of scissors?
He was mad. He'd gone psychotic. So he was wanting to kill as many people as he could, and he basically wanted the police to bring his kids to the hospital. He wanted to see his kids. And that was the sort of request that came through all the psychotic behavior.
On air, online, and podcast, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
George Kolreese was a hostage negotiator with police forces in the United States for several decades. Now he advises on leadership and he teaches at university in Switzerland. He's in Australia for the Leadership in Complexity Summit that's being held at Queensland University of Technology. You were telling us how you were brought into the situation where a very angry and distressed and paranoid man was in a hospital emergency room. He had a nurse he was holding hostage with a pair of scissors. He was angry. He was wounded himself. And the police decided that you'd be the best person to deal with him, George, as the consulting psychologist for the local police force. Now, this was a period of the 1970s again, wasn't it? Was there any training in these kinds of things?
This actually happened in the late 60s, 68, and there was no training. I mean, there was no hostage negotiation teams at that point.
So there you are in this situation. You went into the room, and there he was. He was very angry and distressed, threatening to kill many people, as you
say. Psychotic. He was psychotic.
He was psychotic. What did you do then?
Well, what that means is he's not responding to any transactions. So every question, every statement was blocked. And after about 3 minutes, he had the scissors at Sheila's throat, and in total—
The nurse's throat, yes.
Yeah. And then he cut her throat, not her jugular, but the side. So she was bleeding profusely, but not life-threatening, but it was serious on the side of her neck. And that startled him, and he stepped back, screaming, and then he said something about, I caused this because I wouldn't get his kids there. And then he came across the room towards me with that scissors. And in a nanosecond, I had to decide, do I throw my body at his feet? Do I call the police in? Or do I keep talking? And a little voice said, keep talking. And I did. But it got worse for me. He now put the scissors to my throat. I instinctively put my hands up around his arm and looked him in the eyes and said, Sam, that was his name. What do you want? Screaming and shouting, still no response. I have to say, Richard, I rarely have seen that kind of hatred and fear and deep pain that was in his eyes. With no response, I eventually took a risk and said, how do you want your children to remember you? And that was a turning point.
Why? What did he say?
He screamed back, get my kids here and I'll kill them too. I hate them. And it was filled with venom. But that was a turning point.
Why?
Because he responded to my question. We now are connected. It wasn't the answer I wanted. I thought, we're in big trouble now. But it was a connection. It was a response to my question. How do you want your kids to remember you? Then I came back again, daring myself, and said, Sam, we have to talk about your kids. And he screamed, I don't want to talk about my kids. I told you that. Get them here and I'll kill them. But see, there's two transactions there where we're linked. We're now bonded. We're now connected. And then that was a turning point. And pretty soon he started thinking, he said, I'm going to kill myself. And I said, well, then how do you want them to remember you? As a murderer, as somebody who commits suicide? And then we get into a dialogue. Within 10 minutes, we were able to then make the first negotiation, which was to get Sheila out of that room. And we succeeded. He left her go. He was bleeding profusely, and with another 20 minutes, and this happened over time, he gave up the scissors, and I negotiated, do you want to give it to me or throw it on the floor? He said, I'll give it to you. He had to be handcuffed to go out of that room, and so again, the choice, do you want the police to come in? You want me to do it? Do you want to be handcuffed in the front, in the back? See, always when you give choice, ask questions. That's the most powerful tool. Listen, and then ask the right question. And then he walked voluntarily out of that room.
What did he say to you as he was leaving?
He didn't say anything. He was still in a total confused state, and they led him away with the police, the lieutenant. And then as they were going out, he said, "Can I go back and say something to George?" And the lieutenant said, "Okay," and accompanied by two officers, because they didn't know if he was going to attack me or what. He comes up, puts his hands up. Now, he's got his handcuffs in front of him, because I asked him, "Do you want to be handcuffed in the front or in the back?" He looks at me and says, "George, you're okay. I'm glad I didn't kill you." And I said, "Thank you, Sam." And me too. And then he said, "I want to thank you." And I said, "For what?" "For helping me remember how important my kids are to me." See, I knew he was grieving about his kids. I picked up on that, fortunately, that he was in deep, deep grief. And I connected to that, and we reached a deal, which was very simple. "I will go to your kids and tell them you gave up because you love them. And if you give up now, I can go to the judge and honestly say that he cooperated at the end and we can get your sentence reduced. And I will come to the prison and help in the family reconciliation with your kids." And he bought the deal.
What's the connection between his thought, which was, "I miss my kids terribly, I'm being deprived of their company, and I'm so distressed about it," to "bring them here and I'll kill them"?
It was his legacy. It was, do you want them to remember you as a murderer? Because he had the possibility of suicide. And this is the most dangerous, where somebody is willing to have somebody kill them as opposed to them killing themselves. So the key was, how do I want my kids to remember you? See, I knew one thing. He loved those kids. But he was an unstable man. He was paranoid. He was psychotic. But deep down, he did love his kids.
He might have been really delusional, too. When
he was totally. This.
But I mean, like, he could have thought you were the devil. He could have been ill in that way and wanted to kill the devil.
Yeah.
What then? What, you know?
Then I would, what makes you think I'm the devil? See, a question. You always keep coming. What makes you think I'm the devil? And you look for a little thing to keep on that path. Well, if that's true, then how can this be? And you get into the mind of the paranoid person and help them begin to see some little bit of reality, and they have to trust you. If you can't get trust, you can't get caring involved, it will never work. That's why the biggest training we have to do with police who become hostage negotiators is help them learn how to care if they don't already do it.
It's just so interesting to me that you're being pushed into this situation, and there's a very angry, paranoid man there who's got a nurse's hostage. He's got a blade on her throat, and he cuts her throat a little bit, not fatally, as you say. But still within that moment, I suppose you have to think, that poor man, what's wrong with him?
Yeah, I have to. And I have to control my instincts, because the instinct is to have the startle response of pulling back, but you have to control. It's like if I would throw these headphones at you, you would have a startle reflex. You have to train not to let those earphones hit you.
Make an interesting interview moment, isn't it?
So you have to train your own emotions not to escalate fear. It's a very powerful training process, which anybody can learn. You have time for another very short story? A little old lady wakes up in the middle of the night, man standing over her bed with a club, ready to kill her. She looks up and looks him right in the eye and says, "Oh, you must be cold. You must be hungry." Her granddaughter's in her bed, wakes up. She puts her hand on the granddaughter's head and says, "Well, he's just hungry and cold. You can go back to sleep." She gets out of bed, walks him into the kitchen like a little old grandmother, makes soup. They talk. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. She says, "It's too cold out there. It's snowing. You're going to catch a cold. Let me make a bed for you behind the stove." Totally discounting the club. He goes to sleep. She goes back to bed. The next morning, the police arrive with a canine unit, and they are shocked to find that this grandmother is still alive, because this very man, with that very club, had brutally killed a family of four, two parents and two children, 2 miles up the road from her house. But see, she created so much bonding, he could not kill her. Now, that's the secret of violence de-escalation. People do not kill people. They kill objects, they kill things, and they go through this depersonalization process. And we live in a culture that is becoming more and more depersonalized.
Were you angry at having been thrown into that situation? Because there you were. You didn't have any weapons on you, I'm assuming, did you, apart from your voice? Were you furious when you came out of that?
I was enraged. I said, we always do debriefings after a major crisis incident. And I said,
did you turn into the angry, paranoid, demented man ready to attack someone?
No. I turned to the lieutenant and said, I got to talk to you before we do the debriefing. And I've said to him, how dare you send me into that? I didn't sign up for this. I should be home with my own kids. And he put his hand on my shoulder, Richard, and he said, while looking at me right in the eye, I said, George, I knew you were the one to do it. I knew you could succeed. And I did ask you. You could have said no. He became a secure base for me. He became a lifelong friend. And that changed my life. That really changed my life.
What is underlying these cases of paranoia? What underlies paranoia?
Fear. It's the survival mechanism that activates this strong amygdala response, and you begin to live in danger, because there are dangers in the world. But when you become fearful that something is going to destroy you, then it kicks up that whole paranoia. And behind the fear is always loss. So that it's the anticipation of a loss. It's the anticipation you're going to lose something, even in your own identity. And it can be totally delusional what you're going to lose. But it's the combination of fear and loss that then can turn into anger, and it can turn into a real strong behavior, like this incident in Santa Barbara. I don't know if you heard about it, where this man killed six kids. He went to the fraternity. He had activated a whole mechanism because he was rejected. He was in grief, and he became paranoid about why they didn't want him. And loss is the most important thing leaders can understand. It's what is behind 80% of all motivation.
When the police asked you to become more involved in hostage negotiation scenes, was it something you were happy to do, or was it kind of a terrifying, reluctant duty that cost you deep? Because I can't imagine how can you do this thing repeatedly, George, without suffering from something like post-traumatic stress disorder or something like that, where you're in a state of constant hyper fight or flight, hyper awareness, in danger of losing your life?
That's where you have to control that instinctual response and the startle reflex in the amygdala, so that you actually see it as success. It actually produces a kind of calmness. I am in a certain calm state. And then in a good hostage negotiation, you don't pay attention to fear. You're only focused on flow. You're doing things. So I had three other incidents where I was taken hostage.
Three other times you were taken hostage.
Yeah, so there were a total of four. And that was because of the volatile situations that I would get into. The police couldn't always take the weapons away. But I learned something, that my most powerful weapon, Richard, was talking, not carrying a gun. I was being trained to carry a gun, and I told the chief of police, I don't want to carry a gun. My weapons are my words. And so when I began to understand what was really happening, they wanted me to get involved in training and setting up hostage negotiation teams.
One stage, one of those situations where you were taken hostage was in your office.
Yeah.
In your office. What happened there?
Well, I took a lot of guns away from people and knives who were suicidal and so forth. But he brought a gun in, and he wanted me to convince his wife not to divorce him. So I was dealing with very violent people, and he was quite determined. He just rushed past the secretary and came barging into my office, actually during a session.
With a gun?
With a gun.
What kind of a gun?
It was a small pistol.
Handgun.
Handgun, yeah. And he said, I'll kill you unless you do this, and you got to call my wife right now.
Did he point the gun at you?
He was pointing it right at me.
Well, so, right up on your head or what?
No. He was standing at the door. I was about 10 feet apart, which initially, then he came closer. But the gun is the most dangerous weapon, because a bullet can go across space. So the first thing I had to do is get the client out of the room that I was seeing. And then I said, look, let's talk about this. What do you want me to say to her? And why do you want to come back? So questions. So you don't put the gun down. You don't try to command and control. You go in. What do you want me to say to her? Well, what if she says this? What would you like me to tell? And I said, well, will you sit down while we talk this? And so he sat down and he put the gun down. I said, that gun makes me very nervous. Will you take it off your leg and put it to the side? You have the gun. And so we continued to talk. You could do the same thing, Richard. You could be like the little old grandmother.
That's very nice of you to say so, George. I hope I never find out whether I can do it.
But you see, this is the thing, the connection to leadership, Richard, is that words and how the leader uses the words can either provoke and push people deeper into the resistance or the negativity, or they can solve the conflict. They put the fish on the table and get the conflict solved.
Now, at this time, I know you were also working on reform of mental health institutions in the United States, too, as a psychologist. What were you trying to change there?
Well, I was teaching what they called mental health technicians, and the goal was, because they called them insane asylums and then state hospitals. These were torture chambers where people who were very psychotic, schizophrenic. So the goal was to send in young technicians who were trained in conflict management to deal with people, talk to people, de-escalate them. Throwing someone into isolation is cruel if you can teach someone to talk to them. So this was part of them to help transform those institutions and get people out into community mental health centers. John F. Kennedy created that community mental health center process, and we knew this was not a sustainable process to lock all the insane people up.
Through all this time, you had a family, you had a son, and your oldest son was killed in a motorcycle accident. Is this what you were speaking of before, about learning how to go through processes of grief?
Yeah, it was the horror of my life. He was 23. And he wanted to be a doctor. He was getting ready to go to medical school. And right in front of the hospital, as he was ready working at the hospital, he was hit by a truck. And he lived for 5 days in a coma. And it was the deepest grief of my life, deeper than my mother or grandfather or the other people who had died in my life. And so I had to come through it, and I turned to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross because I already understood grief, but I had to go through it myself, all the emotions, and come back to the joy of life. 3 years later, I have another son, Andrew.
He's with you today.
Yeah, he's here today. And he deserves a father who's filled with joy. He deserves a father who really is attached to him, not longing for the son who has died. And so this is part of the lessons of life that what hostage negotiators have to understand with people who can't get over loss and they turn it into revenge or turn it into whatever, that happiness is a choice. Happiness is a choice. There is nothing you can't get over, even loss of a child. And I have to say, Richard, the biggest lesson I got from that was what Elizabeth Kubler-Ross helped me understand, that you live your life to honor the people who have passed away before you. And so I was recently with a father who was driving a car, and his 18-year-old daughter was with him, and he hit a tree, his fault, and she's paralyzed today. Now, how does he go through that grief? How does he come back to the joy for that daughter who is still alive, who can't speak, and for his other kids? So what I learned from that is resilience, deeper, deeper resilience. And once you're through something once, then another time it doesn't seem as bad. And that's why, to the parents out there who are listening, we can't rescue our kids from pain, but we have to support them and help them through it and be able to get over it. Anything so that you live your life without regret. And the majority of people are living not fully joyful lives. They live with too much worry, too much fear, too much regret, or fear of losses in the future.
When Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was talking to you about your grief, you know, she's famous for that theory of the five stages of grieving, which is what, denial, anger,
bargaining, depression,
and acceptance. Acceptance.
Yeah.
Is that true? Is that process? Was that the process for you, or is it in a different order? Or
yeah, except I expanded it to 10 so that I have a more detailed process that I learned for myself and from other people to go deeper into that emotions. Forgiveness is at the end, and the final stage is gratitude. You have not come through grief if you don't come back to the joy of life. Don't come back to the joy of your job. So you lose a leg, you lose something, and can you come back to really feeling gratitude again? And some of the most joyful people in the world can't walk. They've had tremendous losses, and yet they still see life as a joyful process.
It must be hard to see at the beginning of that process. Yeah, the idea of a joyful life.
You can't do it without help. Either help from another person, what we call a secure base, and that was the point of the second book, Care to Dare. How do we find secure bases who help inspire us? Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was a secure base. Lieutenant Dan was a secure base. These help you inspire and see what is possible. When he said to me, George, I knew you could do it. You were the right one to go into that room. To this very day, those words ring in my ear, in my head, when I face a fearful situation.
Were the police grateful for you?
Oh, I loved them. They loved me. I was one of the brothers. I never became a sworn officer, but I interacted with so many people from the police department, the sheriff's department, the state police department. I mean, I became a sort of, if I can say, a little bit of a legend.
Yeah, because any decent police officer...
I was one of the brothers.
You know, I know that contrary to most belief, police don't like walking into a scene all guns blazing at all because, you know, innocent people might get killed and they might get killed. So for someone to go in without a weapon and to defuse a situation without bullets being discharged or people getting killed, it must be a great relief to those officers and those people concerned.
It was another way to think about how to handle conflict, that having a weapon using force, command, and control is not the solution all the time. Sometimes you go into a barroom ball, you have to use force. But I recently met a nuclear submarine captain who turned the whole ship around. It was a disaster, a nuclear ship, by saying, I give up my control. I allowed leadership to be developed at every level. And he said, running a nuclear submarine, he wrote a book about this, Turn the Ship Around, is not based on command and control. It's based on engaging people in a leadership role of doing everything they can do at the point that they have responsibility for. And that's what police have to learn also, that it's easy to turn to force, but can you engage someone who is upset and de-escalate them? And we have great, great police officers who do that, and we have others who do not.
Are police more and more being trained into the kind of techniques you're talking about?
Oh, absolutely. Emotional intelligence. In the past, sometimes police had the emotional intelligence of a mosquito. And what do you want to do to a mosquito? You want to whack him. No, there's a lot of training about how to create empathy, how to feel compassion. And there's danger in the work because some occupations, you lose the ability to feel compassion. Doctors can lose it. Police officers can lose it. Teachers can lose it. Because all of these principles are really principles of how to influence and persuade other people through empathy, through compassion, genuine caring. The day you stop being a genuinely caring human being, you lose something in your own life. And one of my missions with leaders is to come back to that empathy and that compassion for their own children, for their own spouses, for their own friends, because so many people's lives are destroyed because they don't have compassion.
One of the reasons why there are hostage situations in the United States is because of the prevalence of guns, of course, there. I mean, what do you have views on that? And the, you know, the several attempts there have been for gun law reform in the United States?
Well, Americans are a little crazy about guns, a lot crazy. I mean, there's too much sense of paranoia behind it. I grew up on a farm where guns were part of it, but when you mix guns with paranoia, so we need regulation. It's insane to give certain people guns. And the whole thing about what a gun represents to Americans is a very powerful thing. So we have to have regulations, and we know regulations do work. It's not to take the guns away, but to regulate. And the idea that guns don't kill is a sort of distorted view of what really has to happen. I mean, our rate of killing with guns is out of control.
That kind of view is unpopular in the United States.
I know.
Why you need to teach in Switzerland these days, I wonder.
Well, I have a very good and there are a lot of police who are also supportive of gun regulation. It's not taking the guns away. It's about regulating who gets a gun and how the gun is used. But everybody wants to have a gun to protect themselves. And the stand and shoot that happened in Florida, stand your ground, this is bizarre that you can kill a human being out of paranoia.
Is it more dangerous to be in a hostage situation where someone has a gun pointed or a knife at your throat?
Always a gun, because a bullet can travel a long distance. So you have a chance with a weapon, like a scissors or a knife, to use your hands to, you know, show a certain amount of defensiveness. But a bullet can be shot with impulse. And this is often what happens, is that many, many hostage situations are impulsive. So the person is in such hyper alert that any kind of little emotion triggers them. It's like when a police officer shoots someone who reaches for their pocket and there's no gun. It's that startle reflex in the amygdala that is so dangerous.
And it just needs just a twitch, doesn't it, as well? That's the other thing. It just needs that.
Human bonding. Human bonding.
to actually shoot a weapon like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's it, as opposed to a knife, which requires you to actually step forward and really do something quite physically repulsive and heinous.
Like road rage. I mean, if you got a gun and you're in suddenly enraged, you can shoot that gun in less than a second, whereas the knife would not be nearly as dangerous.
It's been fascinating speaking with you, George, and to have your perspective. You were looking for a purposeful life. I suppose you found it. It wasn't in the priesthood like you thought it may be as a kid, but you found it anyway.
I feel I'm doing God's work in my own life, and my goal is to make the world a better place by starting with how the father and mother and how a family can be created.
So you've remained a religious man after that time?
A spiritual man. I, the Pope would have some challenges with me, but I'm certainly a practicing Catholic, but I'm a very spiritual person.
Maybe not the new guy, I don't know.
Yeah, he's quite a guy. He's a very, very interesting leader.
It's been really great to speak with you, and thank you so much, George. It's been absolutely illuminating. I really thank you for being my guest
today. You're quite welcome, Richard. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.